You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Every once in a while, a book comes along which dominates the culture, a book that everybody seems to be reading. And then they make a big Hollywood movie out of it, which everyone goes to see, and all the people who read the book are disappointed, but it's a big hit anyway. Recently, it was The Girl on the Train, and before that it was Gone Girl, and before that it was The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. But the phenomenon started before all those girls. One of the first books to capture the national attention in this way was the legal thriller called Presumed Innocent. It was published 30 years ago and was the debut novel of a young lawyer named Scott Turow. It sold millions, and it was made into a successful film starring Harrison Ford and directed by Alan J. Pakula, who directed All the President's Men. Since Presumed Innocent, Scott Turow has written 10 other novels, which have sold more than 30 million copies. His latest novel is called Testimony. Scott Turow, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, what's it like to be in the center of that kind of attention when Presumed Innocent came out?
Well, you know, there was a piece of me that kept saying, don't trust it, don't trust it. You've been through this before. And I couldn't really understand my own thought process. And then I realized, oh, I know what this is. This is like being an infant again, where everybody, you know, hangs over the edge of the crib and goes, isn't he so cute? It's a brief moment, and that's pretty much what it feels like.
Well, people always said David O. Selznick, you know, he made Gone with the Wind, and then he struggled the rest of his career to try to match it, or Citizen Kane with Orson Welles. So has it been a problem that your gigantic success was your first book?
First of all, it provided a tremendous opportunity for me. I think every author is grateful to get that chance and to have an audience. And, you know, I never really felt that I could fully explain Presumed Innocent. And I didn't feel obliged to do it. And, you know, I'm proud of the books I've written since. They've all been bestsellers. And, you know, I really am grateful for that and don't spend a lot of time getting involved in number crunching. And,
right.
But in pure numbers, The Burden of Proof sold more, the second novel, which is, you know, very often the case with the...
Right, because everyone is hanging.
Smash, right.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I, as I said, I've been really blessed as a novelist, and I've had a wonderful career, and I don't complain.
And you don't, you know, I mean, I think your books have gotten better and better, but that's just me.
Well, you know, I like what I've written. I don't like every book as much.
Uh-huh.
I was very satisfied with Testimony when I finished it. And, you know, and I, sometimes years pass, you read a book again, and you go, oh, yeah, that wasn't that great. So I don't know what my own final judgment will be, but, you know, I happen to like this book a lot.
You don't write as rapidly as some thriller writers. You don't have 35 books out there or 75.
I don't. And, you know, I don't knock the people who do that. I am not capable of that. I can say that my fingers don't move that fast. But, you know, to each his or her own. And, you know, if I could write faster, I would write faster. But I don't think it would be as satisfying to me.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a little bit more about Presumed Innocent before we move on.
Sure.
Since they made a movie, and it was directed by Alan J. Pakula, one of my favorite mm-hmm. film directors.
Mm-hmm. And a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful human being. He, a peach of a person.
I sure miss his work. He left too soon. What was that like? Were you involved in the movie?
Well, you know, it was all new to me at the time. And, you know, Harrison Ford, who really was the... he certainly was the biggest star in American film at that moment, played the lead, and he turned out to be a remarkably approachable, decent guy who, you know, visited in my home, and I saw him when I was in Hollywood. And, you know, the whole thing was, the whole experience of Presumed Innocent was otherworldly.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you have a fantasy, and you hope someday it'll come true, and then it comes true, and because it's so much of what you've hoped for, you don't really know whether to get into it or not. But, you know, I found making a movie to be, I'm hardly the first person to say it, far less glamorous than I expected it to be. And, you know, it's just the same thing done over and over and over again. And, but, you know, I became close friends with Brian Dennehy, who was Harrison's co-star and remains a good friend to this day. I loved Alan Akula. He was just a real prince, and was always very kind to me. A lot of the people on the other side of the camera, rather than the actors, were every bit as interesting as the actors themselves. So, you know, it was a knockout experience. I had a great time, and you know, I was on the set and a couple of times and treated well. You know, but it's just weird. It's just, you know, these were for the most part words that I had written in my basement or on the morning commuter train, and you know, all of a sudden there's 150 people on a soundstage trying to give them a physical reality.
Acting it all out.
It's just one of those things. You know, life is strange, and that's a really strange experience.
I can imagine. It'll never happen to me because I have this one thing that will keep it from happening to me. Is I've never written anything. It's like holding me back.
That'll hold you back.
But other than that, I'm waiting for this moment to happen to me. I want to ask you about, in terms of the point of view of writing, because when they make the movie, you know, then the camera becomes the storyteller. Pakula becomes the storyteller. In your books, almost all of them, I think, are first-person narratives. Do you always write in first-person?
No, I've written, Testimony, you're right, is in the first-person.
Yeah.
I've written books in the third-person as well. The Burden of Proof was in the third-person.
Oh, uh-huh.
You know, it's been about half and half. I go back and forth. There are certain things I like about writing in the third person. You sort of can give vent to your literary side a little more, a little more openly. So I've gone back and forth, and I've fooled around with tense. You know, Presumed Innocent was in the present tense, and some books have been in the past, and you know. But you are who you are as a writer, and it's going to be. You know, by the time I'm 68 now, and I am who I am. I inhabit my own skin every morning when I get up, and you know, certainly when I sit behind the keys of the computer.
You're the 68-year-old young novelist who's just written Testimony, Testimony is great, and I really loved it. But I was thinking about this first-person thing. Who, if I can ask, who do you think he's talking to? Is he talking to me? Who's he talking to? Who's he telling the story to?
There are obviously the convention of the first person, you know, derives from somebody standing next to you at the water cooler and telling you a story. And, you know, there are all kinds of literary conventions that don't make a lot of sense when you think about them. For example, how can it be suspenseful to the character if a book is written in the past tense?
Right, you know he's not going to get killed because he's telling.
Right, he or she already knows what happened.
Why don't they just tell me the ending first and then they can fill in?
Who is the first person is meant to imitate? You know, a story told by someone sitting at your table. Of course, the language is hardly the same, but the intimacy of the first person telling you directly what was going on inside their head and their heart, and you know, and that's the appeal of it.
I think there might be limitations to it. Like you said, you would know. I mean, at one point, some of your characters. I don't want to give no spoilers. Some of the characters in Testimony are in mortal danger, but you sort of, you know, because he's telling it to you, you know, he's probably not going to get killed. But also, I want to ask you a little bit about sex, because your books often have explicit sex in them, and sex was a key element in Presumed Innocent, and there's some sex in this book. And you know, if a person's talking to me, they don't usually. It's very explicit to some of the things. So how do you decide when to use explicit sex?
You know, it's a matter of intuition, and I think a lot of the sex and testimony is fairly discreet. I mean, there are some scenes that are pretty direct, but all in all, it's not quite as...
Well, it's not a dirty book.
No, it's not. You know, but Presumed Innocent, there was a lot of very frank description of Rusty's sexual interactions with Carolyn Bulimus. And, you know, there is some... there are some sex scenes in Testimony. For the most part, I think, you know, Bill Tenboom is a little more elliptical than Rusty was. But, I think sex is a very important part of life. And I think people spend a lot of time thinking about it. And if they're lucky, actually doing something about what they're thinking. And it has tremendous gravitational effect on people. I've never quite understood the term casual sex. I mean, I don't. What does that mean? Does that mean you only think about it for the next 4 days? So, you know, it's not everything in life, but it's certainly very important, particularly in terms of the relationships with, you know, the people with whom you're intimately involved. So, and I've never been inclined to shy away from that truth.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. We're talking tonight with novelist Scott Turow. His new novel is Testimony. His first book, Presumed Innocent, was published 30 years ago. When you write a novel like this one, this is a long and complicated novel, and I don't mean long in a bad way. It's love, you know. It's great
it's
that it's long.
Got a lot of pages, right?
Yeah. I'm happy that it's the length that it is, because it's so satisfying. But you have to keep a lot of things in your head. So when you set out to write a novel like this, do you know everything? And then you just have to write it down, or do things happen that surprise you when you're writing it, or what's it like?
You know, you asked before about, you know, why it takes me so long to write a book, and what I'm about to describe is one of the reasons, which is I sort of feel my way through a book, and initially I allow myself to write whatever I want to write. I get up in the morning, I try to make sure I write, and it's harder and harder when I'm starting. But if I want to write a piece of dialogue that I've imagined overnight, I'll write that. If I want to write about the background of a character, I will do that. If I want to set a scene somewhere, I will do that. Whatever I feel inspired to write, I think, in the early stages, is got some emotional power, and I'll be able to make use of it one way or the other. So, you know, that's how I begin. So there are a lot of blank spots. There are a lot of things I don't know, and there's a lot of invention that goes on in that initial phase. You know, do I know that Bill Tenboom is going to leave Kendall County and go to The Hague, and work as a prosecutor at the International Criminal Court. Yeah, I certainly know that much. But, you know, certain characters, when they appear, are sometimes as surprising to me as they are to readers. And I know what a fundamentally romantic, even silly, statement it is when novelists say the characters take on a life of their own. And yet I don't know a novelist who fails to say that. It's what we all experience. And, you know, you're playing with your imaginary friends, and very often they start answering back.
Yeah. And your characters, your books all take place in a universe that they know each other, the Kendall
right.
County universe.
Right.
And you kind of visit there, I guess, when you write.
I do. It's my imaginary hometown.
And there's a baseball team. There's all kinds of stuff that happens.
Yeah. A Cub-like baseball team called the Trappers. I don't know how, in the next book, my characters are going to handle the impossibility of the Trappers winning the World Series.
Well, I hope it happens.
I hope so too. I think there's a certain fidelity to reality that I have to exhibit.
Well, I want to ask you about the age of your characters versus your age, since you mentioned your age
mm-hmm.
earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So, when you first started writing novels, your characters were about your age, and now they're considerably younger than you?
Let's think.
A little bit younger.
That's true. I can go book by book, but, you know, Ten Boom is about, you know, he's 13 years younger than I am now. He was about 10 years younger when I started writing. And, you know, Sandy Stern, when I wrote The Burden of Proof, was 15 years older than I was. So, you know, there's a... I'm not sure I could write about somebody who was 18
mm-hmm.
anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, within the range of adult experiences that I've had, I think I tend to write about characters who are... who fit somewhere in that age range. Next book is probably going to be about a man who's in his mid-80s now.
Wow.
You know, I'll be going there in the near future.
I hope we read it before we're in our mid-80s. Now,
I hope so, too.
Let's talk a little bit about Testimony, and again, we will be very careful and not spoil the story for anybody, but it involves a atrocity that took place in wartime, and I want to know how much is this something that you had to research, and or could you just create it all?
Well, the actual crime that is imagined at the center of Testimony is purely imaginary. American NATO troops who were part of the peacekeeping force in Bosnia are suspected of having murdered 400 gypsies, 400 Roma, in a refugee camp near the circle of American bases that in the American quarter, the American quadrant of Bosnia. Nothing like that ever happened with our troops in Bosnia. As a matter of fact, everybody I talked to drew impressive comparisons with the other peacekeeping troops from other countries, including some of the Western countries, who sometimes didn't behave anywhere nearly as well as our troops did. But I wanted to get at the peculiar relationship the United States has had with the International Criminal Court in The Hague, where Ten Boom works as a prosecutor, and that obviously is exposed most directly if Americans are the suspect. So, but the crime that is imagined is, as I said, it is certainly not something that happened. That said, like Ten Boom, I was far less conscious than I should have been about what was happening in the Balkans in, you know, in the mid-1990s. And you do not have to read very much to read accounts of just horrible atrocities. So it's certainly not something that is remote from the experience of that part of the world, nor is it remote from the experience of the International Criminal Court. That is what they do. They investigate and prosecute crimes against humanity. And, you know, there's a certain dreadful similarity in all the crimes that the ICC investigates.
And, of course, anytime you have a war, there are atrocities and war crimes.
There seem to be, and although, you know, the particular crimes that that the ICC investigates very often arise from the complete breakdown of civilization within a society. So there are war crimes, and, you know, we can look at, for example, our time in Iraq, the American time in Iraq, and say that, you know, Abu Ghraib is certainly, that would be defined as an atrocity, and the way the prisoners there were treated would certainly be regarded as a war crime. But it's not on the same level as, you know, as what happened, you know, in World War II. Now, you can argue that our entire invasion of Iraq was a war crime, and you know, I can make and defend that argument. But there are levels of magnitude in even the worst things that human beings do, and certainly the ICC gets involved in looking at, you know, the very worst of human behavior.
And well, as the lawyer in you can make and defend arguments on either side of all the issues that you talk about?
Yeah, I can. I mean, I wouldn't. I was dramatically opposed to the war in Iraq, but I would not argue that it was a war crime. You know, it took place with the authorization of the government, and frankly, at the time we invaded, the support of most Americans. So it was a very, very ill-conceived adventure as far as I was concerned. And we all know that now that it had many false predicates. But to claim that that is a war crime really diminishes the sort of horrible, wanton behavior that, you know, that most war crimes represent.
Pol Pot or Adolf Hitler.
The genocide is certainly the worst of war crimes. You know, as I said, the treatment of prisoners at Abu Ghraib was unquestionably a war crime.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with Scott Turow, who 30 years ago made his name with a novel called Presumed Innocent. His new novel is Testimony. Well, let's talk a little bit about politics a little bit more. You,
sure.
You're involved in, or you have been in opposition to the death penalty in the United States, which is neither presidential candidate in the last election is opposed to the death penalty. Is it a lonely? Is it a lonely spot there?
You know, it's less and less lonely. Frankly, the death penalty enjoys diminishing support in this country. My home state of Illinois, along with a number of other states in this country, has abolished the death penalty in the last 5 years. And as I said, they're not alone. New Jersey, Maryland, Nebraska, of all places, has also abolished the death penalty. And I think people are slowly coming to terms with the fact that it doesn't do what it's supposed to do, and involves spending a lot of money to get rid of a very, very small
do you think the mood of the country is kind of strange right now? How do you think people are leaning? I mean, there's this kind of been a rash of executions, trying to get under the wire, execute as many people by Tuesday as we can.
Yeah, right. In Arkansas, you know, it depends. You know, to be honest, Gary, what you're talking about. If you're talking about you had a general decline in crime and murder rates, you know, people are less vexed about this issue. On the other hand, when you talk about the death penalty for terrorists, you know, I'm sure there's significant support. So, the art of death penalty arguments is how you ask the question to begin with. You get different poll results when you say, do you believe in the death penalty, or do you believe in the death penalty as opposed to life in prison without parole? And you get different responses, and then you can frame it as life in prison with no possibility of parole. The opposition to the death penalty increases as you make the alternative more absolute.
Well, what if you talk in specifics? Like, let me ask you, how would you argue that it was wrong to execute Timothy McVeigh?
Again, that's a really hard case. And if you could promise me that the death penalty would only be applied to Timothy McVeigh and other people who have murdered 160 persons, including, you know, children, I probably wouldn't be much inclined to argue about the death penalty. But that's not the way it works. And we have constant commitment creep with the death penalty, and pretty soon you're arguing that mothers who kill their children are terrorists and should be subject to the same rules as McVeigh. We can all agree that McVeigh is the worst of the worst. The problem is we do not all agree with what else belongs in that category. And the death penalty has resisted all efforts to cabinet within some kind of reasonable framework. And it always gets away from its legislative creators and ends up being misapplied. And, you know, that's happened to us enough in this country that we have to take the lesson that the thing just doesn't work.
We're talking with Scott Turow. His new novel is called Testimony. Do you think, being a novelist, do you think a novel is a good vehicle for political argument?
No, I don't. I mean, I always have been partial to the Daryl Zanuck line that if you want to send a message, use Western Union. you know, I wrote a novel about the death penalty called Reversible Errors, and when I was done with the novel, I felt that I really hadn't said what I wanted to say about the death penalty. And, you know, I think Testimony is certainly about the International Criminal Court, but it's not an essay about why I think the United States has taken the wrong attitude to the International Criminal Court. I do think that. I think when you really stand back and look at situations like the one in Syria, that it becomes obvious why we need a permanent war crimes tribunal in the world. I'm not using Testimony to argue that point. It is a novel, and you know, it offers some perspectives on international diplomacy and international law. But, you know, it's a story, and it's meant to be really the story of one man who goes to become a prosecutor at the International Criminal Court and for reasons that he does not completely understand. His life has sort of fallen apart, and he's not fully in touch with what is really driving that. And in the course of working in the court and working on this particular case, he gets much more closely in touch with, you know, the issues that have really been driving his life for the last 15 years.
Well, it's a super exciting, you know, adventure novel with all kinds of action and sex, as well as all of these things, and some wonderful characters. I really thought Attila was a fantastic character. How did you come up with that particular one?
That's another of those characters where, you know, I started writing this scene, and Bill Tenboom shows up at the airport in Sarajevo, and somebody comes to pick him up, and I couldn't decide whether this person was a man or a woman. You know, just the way novelists sort of, and I, you know, started thinking, well, what if he can't tell if it's a man or a woman?
That made me laugh. It's Pat. Yeah.
And that, right, it's Pat. And that's a nod to Julia Sweeney, who's actually a good friend of ours. But Julia being the person who created Pat on Saturday Night Live. But, yeah, but it's that, you know, it's that kind of situation. And it was no more thought out than that. You get in the middle of the scene and, wow, what if this is what was happening? And then the character grows off of that. You find as you write hundreds of pages whether you made a mistake or not. But I thought Attila was pretty amusing on most pages.
I think it's a very cinematic story. Do you, anybody interested in making a film or a miniseries of Testimony?
You know, I got an email last week from somebody, and I did what I always do, which is here's my agent's name, contact my agent. So, you know, we'll see what happens. The one thing I've learned is that, you know, I cannot second guess what they're going to want in Hollywood because, frankly, you know, the people who run studios or have production money, many of them don't know from week to week what they want. They're and you know the reality is that we can refer to Testimony as a thriller, but by the standards of what gets made in Hollywood, it's a serious adult story.
There is no superpowered superhero.
Right. There is, you know, there's no one with wings in this book. So. And you know, there's dwindling support for movies like that.
Maybe if you called it Testimony 2.
Right. Testimony 2, Pirates of the Caribbean. And there's so much great stuff happening on TV. I'm not particularly worried about that.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're seeing great cinematic narrative art. It just happens that most of it is on television right now.
Yeah, oh, I just thought of another one you could do. Presumed Innocenter.
Right. Right.
That would go over big. The new book is called Testimony. It's a great one. And the author, one of the great novelists of our time, Scott Turow. Thank you so much for being my guest on From the Bookshelf.
Gary, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Scott Turow. His new book is called Testimony. On Tuesday, June 6, 2017, at 7 p.m., Scott Turow will be at the Mission Viejo Library in Mission Viejo, California. And you can also meet him on Sunday, June 4th, 2017, at the Bay Area Book Festival in Berkeley, California. Or Saturday, June 10th, 2017, at the 33rd Annual Printers Row Lit Festival in Chicago, Illinois. Check out scotttoreau.com for more about this great author. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.